All this week, we've been broadcasting from NPR's New York Bureau, mostly focused on the UN General Assembly across town. But it's also been an opportunity to check in with my old friend and colleague, Robert Krulwich. He's now a science correspondent for NPR, co-host of the program.
The last time you looked, I was an economics correspondent.
Well, yeah,
soon I'll be covering, I don't know, possums.
Foreign policy.
Yeah, it could be.
He also co-hosts the program Radiolab. Over the past few months, you may have heard his stories on the billions of bugs in the air over your head, why and how time seems to slow in the middle of life-threatening events, and how individual crows can recognize individual people, but even crow experts cannot pick out individual crows. Clearly, this is a person who needs help. Your help. If you have suggestions, things you've really wondered about for Robert to look into, give us a call at 800-989-8255.
I don't know whether to be insulted by this or just to keep going with it here.
Email talk at npr.org. I'm just going to finish this intro, Robert.
Oh, okay.
And then you can find links to his recent stories on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And as you've heard, Robert is here with us in the Bureau.
I've actually stepped up. See, Neil and I were like roommates or kind of office mates a few years ago.
At the old place.
The old place. But now I have an office where I can do a rotation in my chair and I have the most beautiful view of the Empire State Building known to man.
Breathtaking. Of course, in the old place, we had beautiful views of Second Avenue.
Yes, that's right.
It was quite a
lots of screaming. Our particular office was located between us and the Israeli embassy and a variety of Palestinians. So downstairs, there was like, all the time. People crying out.
But also around the corner from the Daily News building, which, of course, was the Daily Planet building in all those Superman movies, just one of the most beautiful places ever.
But I think I win because I think graduating from the Daily News building to the Empire State Building is a step up.
Absolutely. I'm going to give you points for that.
Okay.
In any case, what are you working on, Robert?
Right now, I was just working on how much does a hurricane weigh? Not everybody's question, but well, I got to wondering. See, actually, this is where the Empire State Building comes in. One day, I was looking out the window on your dollars, and I saw a little white puffy cloud just settle in right over the Empire State Building, and then in a perfect demonstration of Benjamin Franklin's discovery years ago, the cloud issued a tiny little of lightning, and the lightning clung to the tip of the Empire State Building for 1/1000. I think I was the only person who saw it because I was just looking at it. As I went, yes!
Good thing a dirigible wasn't moored up there.
So I got to thinking, you know, how much does that little cloud weigh up there?
Wait a minute. Clouds, they don't weigh anything.
Well, technically, that's correct. If you brought a cloud down to a scale, it would float, so it wouldn't weigh a thing. But I thought there might be a way to do this. So I called some guy up at NOAA, the National, and I said to him, look, how could we figure out, because we know that a cloud and a big cloud and a hurricane carries a lot of water, could we figure out, so this guy and I sat down, we actually figured out that if we squeeze the clouds, which are made of water vapor, and just squeeze the water into a vessel of some kind, he chose an elephant-sized vessel. Because it would weigh four. You know that an elephant weighs 4 tons. He says, if we just imagine a jar of water the size of an elephant. I said, okay. Oh, how many jars of water are in that little cloud? He said, about 100 elephant weights.
What?
I said, no. It would fall down, wouldn't it? And he said, actually, there are some puffy clouds that would hang above the Empire State Building that might literally weigh more than the Empire State Building. This amazed me. And so I spent the next few days just working over the story.
Well, if that's a puffy little white, you know, René Magritte cloud over the Empire State Building, a hurricane must be...
A hurricane is 100 million elephants floating in the sky's worth of water. It's an enormous amount of water. But, you know, sometimes when you're in the middle of trying to figure this out, you say, you're sure about the 100 elephants? You do wonder a little bit for your sanity, just occasionally.
Just a little bit. I also understand you're working on fast-breaking news on Louis Pasteur.
I was very interested in Louis Pasteur. Actually, yesterday was Louis Pasteur and the Walls of Jericho. So you kind of know that I'm, So in Louis Pasteur's case, I was very intrigued to read that in 1849, Louis Pasteur was sitting around looking at... a jar of basically old grape juice that had gone to vinegar, and next to it he had built a molecularly exactly the same bit of juice that he built with his own molecules, but he thought he had two identical bits of business in each tube. He then took a light and shined it on the vinegar, which came from a grape, which was from a living thing, and the light hit the grapes and went ka-choing, and went sort of sideways. He then poured the light on the laboratory solution, and the light was absorbed completely. He said, gee, I think these things are exactly the same, but there's something about grape juice that makes the light work differently. He thought and he thought. And this is what really smart people can do.
Mm-hmm.
He tried orange juice. He tried lemon juice. He tried a variety of things that had once been alive, shined light, and the light consistently bounced in a particular direction. When he built those same molecules in the lab, never been alive, just in the lab, the light was totally absorbed. I don't understand this. I don't understand this. And he eventually discovered that everything that is alive has a twist in it, that there's something deep in nature called chirality, and that everything that is made, every animal, every plant, every human, everybody, every bit of lettuce, every bit of spinach, every tuber, every everything, down to every bacteria, everything twists in a particular direction. And he turns to his professor. He was 23. He says, I think I have just discovered that the universe is asymmetric. So I'm sitting there thinking, what am I doing today? So the rest of the day, I tried to figure out if I could knock down the walls of Jericho, which is the other thing I did. So it's my days are kind of unusual.
Those are unusual.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we have some people on the line who think they have some suggestions for things you can work on. And let's see if we can get a caller on the line. Let's go to Kevin. And Kevin's with us from Kansas City.
Yeah, I just recently visited the Kennedy Space Center, and I didn't get a chance to ask this question when I was there. Why do they hand off communication when there's a launch from Florida to Houston?
That's
my question.
The question is, why do the people
Houston we have a problem
as opposed to Cape Kennedy we have a problem?
Oh, I think that's pretty clear. LBJ, a very powerful senator from Texas, decided to put the money, the people, and the jobs in Texas.
Houston.
Yeah. So
the question.
Yes. So they put the mission control in Houston, along with a lot of other NASA stuff.
Right.
But the launch is handled from the Kennedy Space Center.
Yeah,
and then
so
after it gets to a certain altitude, they say, switch it to Houston, as your airplane gets switched from New York to Boston.
The real important thing, though, is that the 17 jobs to launch the place, or the 1,700 jobs, that's in Florida, but the gajillion jobs to keep the thing up, keep the thing floating, keep the conversation going, land the thing, that's all Texans. So there's a senator who takes care of his own. I think that's probably the answer.
Alexander would like to know about the International Space Elevator. It's fascinating. I even wrote a song about it. I hope you use my song in your report. Here's a quick intro to the whole, and he sends you a link to his song. And thanks. Space Elevator.
I do find the space elevator. First of all, there's something a little odd about getting in an elevator and going up 20 miles and then stopping. What do you do when you get to the top?
I don't know.
You're not allowed out, obviously. Maybe there's like a lobby up there, like a sky lobby. I mean, I haven't built it yet. It's also making me a little nervous.
Didn't that fall down in the 80s?
I would think that if you had a little bulbish kind of thing on the top of the elevator shaft, that you might be a little worried that it would topple. I'm not going to be the first to get on the space elevator.
You'll be the second.
I think I'll be the second.
David's on the line from Las Vegas.
Yeah, hello, Robert. I really love your program, Radio Lab.
Thank you.
It's one of the best shows on radio. No offense to Cog the Nation.
Another one of the best shows on radio.
Yes.
I read an article out of the LA Times about how these University of Utah researchers put a bunch of electrodes on people's heads and were actually able to read their minds, ask the subjects to think of a question and do some language. And it got me, they wanted to put it to stroke victims and other people who couldn't otherwise communicate. There's all kinds of stories there about how you can communicate non-verbally.
Yeah, I'd be a little careful about those things. So when you put electrodes on people's heads, you do get to see something. You get to see the electricity running through their heads. I guess that's reading people's minds. But if you heard that my head went, you don't know whether I'm thinking, I love a mouse. Who was that woman I saw in the subway? You don't know what I'm thinking. You just know that I'm thinking.
Yeah.
They compared the accuracy of it. They had about an 80% accuracy rate, if I can remember the article correctly, depending on the number of electrodes that you use.
What?
Now the scientific experiment was set up.
Well, there is a...
I'd like to know more about that.
Oh, I'd like you to, because there is a wonderfully, wonderfully cool thing that some guys at Harvard invented, which they call a brain bow. And what it is it notices, just as you said, that when people think, little electrical charges go off in their heads, and they decided to track them, kind of like it were a horse race, and you're just kind of watching a particular horse. So they paint the pulses that go through your head, they connect them, and they make them blue and aquamarine and violet and pink and red. And you can sit and look at a person thinking, and you see this wonderful blur of color. shooting blues, then greens, then aquamarine, and you have no idea what
they're
it means.
Thinking, but it looks very pretty.
Yeah, very pretty. And I think one of the great tasks for neuroscience going forward is to look at things like people thinking and then try to figure out how and what they're thinking. But we're a long way from that.
Well,
you could use it as a diagnostic tool if you could, see if different energies have different illnesses, different colors
Aren't they using like PET scans and the various kind of brain scans to say, all right, if I prick you here on the arm and we'll look at the part of the brain that says ow?
They do. No, actually, no, but to take the caller's thought seriously, there is indeed a bunch of people who think that if you look at a schizophrenic or you look at someone who's depressed, or you look at someone who's in great emotional difficulty, they may be able to read those difficulties as flavors on a graph.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody who's purple to green to blue to blue would be, depressed. Someone who's this and that would be schizophrenic. And you could then measure whether a pill makes you better or a doctor who talks to you makes you better, or this or that makes you better. You could begin to compare and contrast treatments and do exactly the diagnostic thing that he's talking about. But it's, again, real early in the game because the brain is a very complex thing and it's doing a whole lot all at once because there's almost a universe in your head. So it's really hard to map a universe.
David, thanks very much for the phone call. We're talking with NPR science correspondent Robert Krulwich. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email following up almost exactly on that point. Carrie in Ann Arbor, I would like Robert Krulwich to investigate how we can tell when someone is looking at us, even when we cannot see them, but you can feel someone's eyes on the back of your head.
That's every third grade teacher who's really good.
And your mother.
They've already been invented, that particular person.
Let's see if we go next to, this is Ellen. Ellen with us from Oakland.
The name is Alec.
Oh, Alec, excuse me.
Sorry.
I'm having terrible problems with the screen.
Hey, you'd make a great Ellen anyway. We kind of sense that.
What your question is about?
My question would be, can you please explore the idea of self-assembling molecules as the basis of life? If you put certain chemicals together, they automatically, just naturally, their nature is to form certain molecules.
Yeah.
And this applies not only to organic molecules, but also to inorganic, some inorganic substances.
Yeah.
So as a basis of life, this basic natural tendency to come together to form what you could say would be the precursors of small organisms. I think, would be a fascinating thing to discover.
What you're describing may turn out to be the biggest question of the 21st century. In the 20th century, very clever people figured out what the building blocks of things are. Like, we know there are atoms now, we know there are in atoms, there are quarks and very colored quarks and protons and neutrons. And you know that inheritance moves through a particular molecule called the DNA molecule. And people found, the individual bottom of the barrel stuff. And maybe one day they'll find that everything's made of string. So a whole 100 years was spent exploring what things are made of. But this century, just like you just said, may turn out to be the century where we ask, how does Humpty Dumpty get put back together again? Why did it take 2 billion years for the living things, which were one cell big, they just sat there being one cell, sat there being one cell.
Very happy.
Happy as a kind. Yeah. And then so much time goes by and none of them thought, let's do it together. Let's make a couple. And then all of a sudden, for some reason, you get multi-cells. Now, what happened that day? And then where did sex come from? And then where did death come from? Those original critters didn't die. They just split in half and went on and split in half and went on. So there are important changes in the way things assemble and disassemble that nobody understands. One of the great challenges of the 21st century is to try to figure that stuff out.
Here's an email from Marjorie in Baltimore. We are being invaded by stink bugs. They look like little bugs in Japanese armor. The entire city of Baltimore is being attacked. No kidding. It's like a plague has descended. They don't do anything except stink if you squish them. Where are they from? When will they go away? What can we do?
Their name is Harriet Biederman. She lives at 55 Baudet Boulevard, somewhere just in Towson, I think. And you should just go and shoot her, I think.
That's the source of the attack.
That's the source of the attack.
Okay, right. Please tell Robert, writes Jim, Please tell Robert if the science gig doesn't work out, he should try out to be Garrison Keillor's next sound effects guy on Prairie Home Companion. His sound effects are almost as captivating as his stories.
You know, Neil and I, we used to do, I would often have Neil come and help me with the sound effects. This is like a secret, though. This is the, we shouldn't say.
Me and Deborah Amos were Mr. and Mrs. Voice.
Yes. Hey, you don't want to know that now that you're
so
a
long,
big
not a big star, right? Yeah. Deborah Amos is a distinguished foreign correspondent.
Correspondent, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Robert, we can look forward to finding out the weight of a hurricane next week on All Things Considered.
Yes, you can. And not only in radio form, but in cartoon form, too. We're working double, multiple media platforms next week.
Good Lord.
Yes,
and
sir.
Radio Lab?
Radio Lab goes on, as always. I'm actually going to Oslo to meet the, for some reason, Norwegian Radio Lab fans who we didn't realize existed. So there you go.
I think they're Danish. No, you're right.
Yeah, I'm going to meet Danish ones, too.
Yeah. All right. Robert, thank you very much.
I don't think you should consider Norwegians as secretly Danish. That's a whole other thing. Maybe that they do at breakfast.
Scott Cameron and Dahlia Martinez produced our coverage from the UN this week. We have many people to thank before we go, including the broadcast and radio staff at the United Nations, especially Julio Martinich and Benjamin Cardle A. Rio and Roy Jokelson and Michelle Dubach. Drew Reynolds, our wonderful technical director in Washington. Today is his final broadcast with us. He will be sorely missed. Special thanks as well to the staff here at our New York Bureau, especially Neil Rausch and Brian McCabe for their hard work and hospitality. Tomorrow it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. And on Monday, as the new healthcare law takes effect, we'll ask NPR's Julie Rovner what the changes are, what's next. Stay with us for that. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.